We're going to do questions for about 15 minutes. How about 15, 20? Okay. We don't want to, I would like to say goodbye personally to all the people who have to leave, so I sort of feel bad. So we won't extend it too long, okay? Because I love to, I'll answer more questions over the book signing later, and you don't have to buy a book. You can just say hi, okay? But if you have a question, how do we do this? Is there any system?
Over here. Over here.
I'd like to do it quick, so.
Yeah.
Are there microphones?
We're ready to get going. Yes, we're ready.
Why not just hand the handheld microphones to people? I'll take the chance of not screening the questions.
Well, we have questions already written.
People have been already
sure. Passing them over to our ushers. Just for those of you who don't know, if you have a question, there's paper and pencil. Every three or four seats, feel free to write a question and pass it to one of the ushers. If you need a card, wave your hand and they'll bring you a card. Or if you want to pass your card to them, wave your hand and they'll bring it, and then people will sort them out. Thank you. I have a question to start with.
Good. Hooray.
Recently, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Education. It seems that we haven't come very far since then. It was a lawsuit that was deemed that separate is not equal.
Brown
versus Education.
Yes.
Where a young black child was being forced out of her integrated neighborhood so that she could attend a black school.
That's
she
right.
Couldn't attend her neighborhood school. The court deemed that that was unfair, that separate is not equal. And for years, we bussed students, black minority students, by and large, because had we bussed white students, the parents would just have left. And they did that anyway.
Yes.
And today, we don't bus so much anymore because most of our urban areas don't have pockets of white middle-class people to be concerned with anymore. Our urban cities are primarily minority. And I wonder if we turn the clock back and the Supreme Court said to you, Jonathan, you're an expert on equality of education. How would you solve this problem? How would you integrate our schools in a democratic society?
Well, believe it or not, I've thought about that quite a lot. And I disagree with the premise of your question that the reason busing, the reason transportation, to use a less loaded term, ceased to be used was because white people fled out of the cities. The fact of the matter is that had it not been for a subsequent Supreme Court decision after Brown, a decision called Milliken, which took place right here in Michigan, the Detroit case, which prohibited integration between adjacent districts, said lily-white suburbs would be left exempt. If it hadn't been for that dreadful decision, which was by the Nixon court, by the way, it was a different court because it had changed drastically since President Nixon came into office. That was Berger and Powell and so forth. If it hadn't been for that terrible decision, the integration would have continued on a massive scale, and it would have been better because it would have included the option of going to the top-funded schools rather than simply another underfunded school in your own district. I might say that during the time in which Brown was most energetically enforced, this is a very unfashionable thing to say. I mean, you won't ever hear this from Clarence Thomas. But you'll hear it from me. You'll hear it from lots of black people who lived through that era and benefited from this. During that era, the achievement gap between black and white children narrowed more dramatically than at any time in a century. And that went on, despite Milliken, it went on for about 25 years. It was only at the start of the 1980s when the Rehnquist Court really decided to rip apart the vestiges of Brown and began to dismantle it and call totally black systems unitary. Remember that? Those of lawyers will know what that term means. That we saw this sweeping return to segregated schooling, though it took a while. It wasn't until about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, that we realized our schools were back where they were in 1968. And to be blunt about it, it's not just that we've ripped apart the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education. Francesca, this young teacher, I love young teachers who are also politically shrewd. She was a wonderful teacher, but she also went out in public as a witness for her students. Though, how many of you educators read a weekly called Ed Week, Education Week? That's the Bible among educators. She started writing for Ed Week. While she was doing first grade stuff with her children. She made green, what do you call that stuff? That sticky stuff. Not Play-Doh. Green slime, that's it, yeah. See, I think that's very important. There's an appendix in my new book. You know how there's usually an appendix which says, like, statistical such and such? I have an appendix called Recipe for Green Slime. I sometimes think we should stick, if our kids get really good at it but make it too sticky, they should stick it on politicians' chairs, make them, not your mayor, but all the others. And she was political, and she once said to me, you know, I just thought this through. It's not just that we've ripped apart the legacy of Brown. We are not even up to the standard set by Plessy versus Ferguson. In 1896, our schools are separate and they're still unequal. There's one very clear proposal that I've made. It's the number one of four items that I'm bringing to Senator Kennedy next Monday, and it's the following. NCLB has a transfer clause. The school's chronically failing after a certain number of years. All American children in such schools have the right to transfer to a high-performing school. It's been a total failure because it's been limited to inner-city districts, and there aren't enough high-performing schools to which these kids can transfer. So only 1% of all the kids in districts like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Detroit, and so forth, only 1% across the board have transferred under this provision. Mr. Bush really fought for this provision because he liked the idea of school choice. Do you see? Because school choice is semantically close to vouchers. It gets all blurred, but the voucher advocates now call it choice. Did you know that? They don't say vouchers anymore because they know that's become a bad word, because I said it's a bad word. But so they say choice. Anyway, the Bush pushed this transfer thing in to appeal to his sort of free market competition folks. Do you understand? Let schools compete. But it failed. What I'm asking the Senate to do is to amend the transfer provision to require states to not only give the right of transfer to any child in a chronically failing school within the district, but also across the boundaries of state districts.
Would you require busing for that?
What?
Would you require that they bus students out? Because so many of the children
it would require
don't have transportation.
Some form of transportation. I don't use the word busing. You know why? Because that's a bad word in America today. The conservatives have managed to pull off this marvelous indoctrinational trick by years of dominating the media in which the vast majority of American children, probably 90% of American kids, go to school by bus every day. Did you know that? Out there beyond the ideological nightmare of New York and Washington, where neurotic intellectuals argue with one another in the pages of the New Republic magazine or something like that. You know, once you get beyond that diseased area of intellect, neurotic intellect, everybody in America knows you don't, if you live in a normal suburban town or in the country, you don't try to get to the supermarket at 3:15 because you're going to get stuck behind the yellow bus and it keeps stopping and the kids take forever to get off the bus. And so, it's only when it has to do with racial justice that it becomes a bad word. The fact is, if they don't like buses, if the I always hear white folks. I never hear black folks, except a few people like Clarence Thomas saying, it's so cruel. It's so cruel to these poor kids to make them ride the bus for, and they usually say for 2 hours. It ain't 2 hours. It's typically about 20 minutes, and you're going against the rush hour both ways, so it's a short ride. If they say, they're wringing their hands, these white folks, you know, and they're saying, what a cruel thing to make these poor little sweet, adorable, lovable black children whom we shun and cheat, to make them go for a 20, 30, 40-minute ride out of a school, out of a district like New York, in which 70% of black boys never get to 12th grade, into a district where almost everybody, black and white and brown, graduates from high school in 4 years, and 90% go to college, and where they spend twice as much money on the kids, and where they don't simply have like one token AP class, but where they have 13 AP classes. And if you get bored with Spanish, which is often the only foreign language in the ghetto, you can take not just French and German, but Mandarin Chinese, for God's sake, and Russian, and where you can take college-level biology and physics classes, organic chemistry, for God's sake. I once asked a black woman in the Bronx how she felt about that. I just said, this was the woman who's, your mayor has told me about reading one of my books, Amazing Grace. And this is a woman in Amazing Grace, a very smart woman. I called Alice Washington. I once said to her, Alice, how would you feel about putting your son onto a bus to go from her home, it would have been 12 minutes to Bronxville, which is the first white suburb. That's the one where they spend $19,000, you know? How would you feel about sending, letting him go to school there, where almost all the kids go to college, class size, you know, 20 at most in fourth grade, at most, you know? High, teachers paid 50% more than they get in the Bronx, so they cream the best teachers from the cities. How would you feel? She looks at me and she says, why are you asking me that, Jonathan? What mother who loves her child wouldn't jump at that opportunity? I said, are you not afraid he would lose his black identity, his black soul, his understanding of African heritage, his respect for kente cloth? If he went to a white, predominantly white school, listen, this is her answer. She's a tough woman and a strong African nationalist, too. She looks right at me and she says, I'll take care of his black heritage. You let him go to the same school that you attended that got you into Harvard. You see? In Boston, we have a voluntary urban suburban program. The black kids who are in the program, 95% of them graduate in 4 years, and of those, 95% go on to four-year colleges, and of those, almost all finish college. One-third of all the black parents in Boston have their kids on the waiting list for that program. Do black people still favor integration? You bet they do if they know that their kids are going to be received with respect and given the same terrific opportunities white children get in America. I think riding the bus is a wonderful idea. But I always tell my white friends who wring their hands in sympathy for these poor little black children who might end up with their kids in the same high schools, I always say, if you really feel bad about buses, go for limousines. Pay for helicopters, you know. Make it a fun ride with audiovisual equipment, you know. Have a French teacher ride the bus with them. Have a black role model ride the bus with them. You know, find young black men who can give these kids, you know. I wouldn't object to some self-help chants if you're on the way to a good school, you know.
Can we go on to another question?
That's what I would do, and I think it's a great idea. Unfortunately, the June 28th Supreme Court decision prohibits the program in Boston. It prohibits not just forced but voluntary integration. That's why we have a big battle on our hands now. And if you folks feel any identification with the longing which is making me put this pressure on a very good human being, Ted Kennedy, good senator, I hope you'll write to your good senators. You have two excellent senators, and they will ultimately have to vote on this on the Senate floor. And I know both of them, and they're both unusually decent human beings. And I hope you'll bombard them with letters and say, now is the time to put your ideals into practice. We want to see you not just nibbling and genuflecting at the edges of a benighted Republican agenda. We want you to stand up for something that will ennoble the Democratic Party, you know. And we want you to stand up for something that will ennoble your own career. I'm telling Senator Kennedy, I want him to do as good as Bobby did.
I have a question from a professional in our audience. I'm a principal who is trying desperately to keep the joy and merriment in our school. We are fighting, literally, to keep a healthy balance for our kids' sakes. It's a day-to-day struggle. Help. What can we do? Be specific. I'll do it. I'm a bit of a rebel. Give me some ideas. I want to keep my job.
Well, that's a principal speaking. A school principal?
Principal.
Well, first of all, you'll have to buy the book. Because you can steal it borrow it, or I'll buy it for you if your salary is too pitiful. Because it's full of suggestions. It's like a survivor's handbook. I mean, it's also a plea to the regular good citizens of America, but packed into it are all these strategies to do what you have to do in order to survive, because I don't want the people who read my books. You know, they're very smart people, and they're nice people. I'm joking, you know, but they are pretty nice people. They wouldn't read my books, and they're compassionate people usually, and I don't want them to leave the schools, and I don't want them to be fired. And so what I do is I sort of pack this book with ways in which you can navigate what is demanded of you while creatively subverting parts of it that are abominable in your eyes. And instead of saying what I would advise principals to do, I'll just tell you three things I urge young teachers to do, because the pattern could follow right through. I urge young teachers, if you're going to do what Francesca did, and that is refuse to play ball with the preposterous requirements of the local versions of NCLB, the MEEP in this case, in Michigan. And if you're going to refuse to play ball with all that stuff and you won't drill your kids for the tests and so forth, you better be really good at what you do in school. You got to teach the skills. You don't need to teach them in a decontextualized manner, which is what the test demand. The test demands basically that you teach these little mini chunks of balkanized cognition, you know, little tiny chunks, like, you know, verb ending number 3 on Tuesday, November 6 at 10 p.m., or no, 10 a.m., I guess. Although now they're extending school. Who knows what they'll do? They'll keep them all night. Well, you got to pass those tests, kid. That's, you know, I urge teachers, if you're going to defy the rules, do it amiably, joyfully, mischievously, charmingly, and teach those skills some other ways. And also, I always urge young teachers to figure out what matters most in the school system, apart from the tests, and take that very seriously. If a school has had a lot of chaos and disorder, a teacher like Francesca, who can keep a calm atmosphere in her classroom, becomes almost inexpendable. Nobody wants to fire her.
because when the superintendent comes around, it looks nice in her class. You know, those little kids look like angels. And they were, they did, I thought they, most of them were like little angels. They loved her, and they wanted, and they obeyed her, not out of fear, because she wasn't scary, except to me. You know, he's picking on me. They obeyed her because they didn't want to give her a hard time, because they liked it when she smiled. And she did, and I also tell young teachers, don't ignore the best of the older teachers, especially the young white teachers. I say, there are a lot of terrific older African-American women in a lot of these schools who have been there for 25 years, and the best of them are like a rock of strength, and they'll teach you a lot. And they know the community. They've known sometimes three generations of the kids, and they can be your opening into that community for a young white girl who's, you know, pardon me saying girl, but they look pretty young to me when they're 22. And Francesca did that. You know, she learned to pay attention, listen to the older teachers. But the main thing I say in the long run is I think sort of a delectable sense of mischievous humor is the ultimate salvation for principals and teachers who have to do some things they don't like but are determined to sneak in a lot of stuff they love and that they know the kids will love. And, you know, the state standards are usually written so poorly that you can, if you're quick on your feet, oh, that's English Language Arts 267B. And the guy, the curriculum cops never check, you know, if you're poised and confident. And besides, what she did to me, she could do to them, too. I like strong young teachers. And they're going to be young white women for a long time to come, so let's look for the strongest ones, the strong, emotionally liberated, unafraid to display their personalities to the kids, which the kids love. They don't think that being professional means to be like bloodless and dull and austere and grim. See, when I was a young teacher, I used to visit my kids' homes because I liked to get to know their parents. Their parents were intimidated and wouldn't come to school at first because my class had 12 teachers that year before I was handed to them. So they didn't trust the school, and they didn't trust the principal. In that case, they were justified because she was a witch, and she was a horrible person. She was racist and mean. But so I visited their homes, and I always timed it for dinner because I wasn't getting paid much. And they would always say, you know, if you haven't eaten yet, sit right down. You know, we have plenty. And that was a good thing because they could do something for you. And it was their turf. So they talked honestly about things. And the principal heard about this, and I brought my girlfriend too, because I was two meals, you see. And my principal heard about this, and she said, "Mr. Kozol, I think your heart's in a good place, but you're going to find that that is going to destroy your professional dignity." So I said, "Why?" And she said,
"You never know." See, she was scared. She said, like, you never know what somebody might think.
So I said, what might they think? Did I get hungry every evening?
She said, you know, that's not what I mean, Mr. Cousin. Bringing your girlfriend with you is particularly unprofessional.
You know, I got this awful thought of what do they mean by professional? You know, and she was very professional in her turns, which is why the PTA meetings were so boring, because she was always so stiff and rigid. I got by the end of the year, I don't mean to be vindictive, because, you know, it's not very Christian, but what the hell, I'm Jewish, so. And I got to hate her so much, by the end of the year, I used to hope that at a PTA meeting or something, she would
trip and bang her knee real hard against the edge of the stage and would bleed. And that it but I used to think it wouldn't be real blood. It would be some kind of professional fluid, you know. Elmer's glue, something like that. Elmer's glue. And so I tell teachers, don't deny your personality. What people love in you in the real world is what your kids will love in you, too. And that's why I love Francesca, and that's why I encourage so many people like her to come in and join us in this struggle, because we need you. And you can make it, you know, no matter what the pressures on the outside, once you close that door, if you really love those kids and you have a sense of jubilation in your soul, you can make it a beautiful year for those children. And hopefully it'll endure into their later years. But no matter what the sufferings they undergo in a still brutally divided nation, they'll at least always be able to remember that year, you know, as a year when they were happy and a year when they knew that they were loved. And that might give them the strength to pull through when they face the toughest odds in later years. That's what I always tell teachers. Give them, you know, look for blessings and then give them one big blessing that they can hold on to for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Let's do one more. One more question.
Okay, last question.
What will it take to make education a priority in this country?
It'll take the militant protests of good people. It will take a new civil rights movement in this nation. It will take people rising up in their indignation, whether they do it quietly by bombarding their senators with letters. Don't send emails, by the way. That's too easy. Send big, thick letters with lots of stamps on them. You know, so their desk gets piled high with letters. You can, if you want to be really nice, you could send them, you want to be really persuasive, send them a copy of a book by Dr. Seuss. Have any of you ever read this with children? It's called Bartholomew and the Oobleck. That's a funny word, isn't it? Well, that should appeal to people around here because it's sort of a Dutch word, Dutch-German word. And it's really green slime. It's a story about green slime. And the king makes a bad decision in that book where he says, I don't like the weather God gave us. I want it to be different. And he gets punished. He has his court magician do some trick, and they get punished by having green slime fall on everything. The green clouds, green slime, and it's sticky. They didn't make it right. See, kids in Francesca's room knew how to mix it properly. If you mix it wrong, it sticks to everything. And the king got stuck to his throne. He couldn't get up off his throne. And he panicked, and he said to the magician, "What can I do to stop this curse that I brought down?" And the magician says, "You'll have to say you're sorry." And the king says, but kings don't say they're sorry. And Bartholomew, the little court page, says, but this time you have to. That's the only way you can rid us of this curse. So the moral of the story is, according to Dr. Seuss, is that everybody can make a mistake, but everybody can be forgiven if he says, "I'm sorry," or she says, "I'm sorry." But even the king has to say, "I'm sorry." So I think we should send that to every member of the Senate who voted for No Child Left Behind. Say, this is your chance. And you should send 1,000 copies to Senator Kennedy and tell him he can give them to charity, but first you're going to send him a high-stakes test to make sure he's proficient in green slime. Let's end there, and I'll get to see more of you later. Thank you.
Mr. Kozel, Thank you so much for joining us for the Great Speaker Series. And thanks to all of you for coming tonight and for your interest and support of public education.